So, well, I was reminded as I was watching you a little bit. I wasn't watching a whole lot because I was doing Sazen. But, but in any event, I was reminded of the first time when I tried to sit a period of Sazen. I was 20 years old, and I couldn't sit still. It was, I mean, it's not like I just couldn't sit kind of still. It was like I couldn't sit still at all. I would squirm on my seat. I would, when I mean I couldn't sit still, I would move like every few seconds. And a lot. not just, you know, like that. I mean, like a big move. And I sat next to, for many, many years, I couldn't sit still for many years. And I would sit right next to Katagiri Roshi, my teacher, and just squirm. Every morning I would be there, and every night, and I'd sit down next to him. And and then there was this other guy, too, who sat next to me for a while. For about 6 months or 8 months, he sat next to me. I'm just putting that in there for a little moment so you can remember. But anyway, I thought, gee, you know, later, I didn't realize it, but as I got older, I thought, gee, I must have drove Katagiri Roshi nuts. I mean, someone just squirming next to you, you know, sitting right next to you. But to the extent of what I moved, I can tell this story. That person who was sitting next to me, like I said, we would sit there every morning together from 5 o'clock to 6:30, and then in the evening from 7:30 to 9. And then he just disappeared, and I didn't see him again until about 8 years later. 8 years later, I met him. Neither one of us had cars, so we met each other on a city bus in Minneapolis somewhere. And I just saw him there, and I thought, "Huh, that looks like that guy who used to sit next to me. I wonder if it is, you know." And so I sat down next to him, and he didn't recognize me, and I kind of looked at him. He kind of looked at me, and I looked at him again. We did that 4 or 5 times. And then I said, did you used to go to the Zen Center, you know? And he said, yeah. And then he says, do you still go there? And I said, yeah, I do. And we sat for about a minute and didn't say anything. And he said, do you still move? So, anyway. So, another thing. Do I understand correctly that most of you are from the Unitarian place? Is that correct? Okay. So, none of you happened to be at Hokyoji last week. Is that, that's a different group, is that correct, of young people?
That's my group.
Yeah, okay. Right, so, okay. I won't go into that. I was going to, if you were, I was going to just hope you had a good time. So. Oh, did you? Good. So no coyotes bothering you?
I overheard a few.
Yeah, we had a bear not so long ago, too, yeah. Knocked down our bird feeder and climbed up onto my car. I thought, oh, what's next? Okay, let's go on with my talk. So like I say, well, like Mike said, we've been sitting here for a few days, a number of us, and we've been studying this piece written by the founder of our school of Zen Buddhism called A Universal Recommendation for Sitting. It's a good thing to study when you're actually doing a long retreat. You know, just why would anyone recommend doing this? So he begins this passage with what I'm going to call koan. That's a Japanese word, and literally it means a public case. That's what koan means. Sometimes you might have heard a famous koan. Probably the most famous koan in Zen is like, what is the sound of one hand clapping? Maybe some of you have come across that. But what it is for one thing, a public case means it's first of all, a case, which means a situation. It's just like a situation. And public means it's not private. It's not personal. It applies to all of us. It's kind of universal. So these are like questions we have about just what it is to live in this world that we come up against. So he starts by saying, he makes four statements, and he follows each of these statements by a question. So let me read a couple of them, or maybe I'll read three of the four, let's say. So he starts with saying, the way is perfect and all-pervading. And then another line he'll say is, the true vehicle is self-sufficient. And another one, it's never apart from where, from this very place. So these are basic things where we see that this reality, there's a way in which it's perfect and all-pervading, just the way it is. But he follows that with a question then, and he says, how could it be contingent upon practice and realization? I will get back to that a couple times, but that's one of the main themes of this piece that he's written. How is it that practice and realization are related? And then he says, the true vehicle, or the way by which we move through this life, is self-sufficient. And he follows that with the question, what need is there for special effort? So why do we have to try so hard? Why do we have to do something? Can't it just be all right just the way it is? Well, one person, this is quite a big question for us. Why do we have to make so much effort? Why can't it be easier, in a sense? So one person went to a Zen master once and they said, I wish to become Buddha. So that means I wish to attain full awakening to everything in the entire universe. Fair enough. So the teacher responded, well, you've set yourself for quite a task, haven't you? And the person responded, he said, well, what if there's no effort? And then the teacher replied, then you're already Buddha. So we have to find that way that we can really make our best effort, yet not too much effort. And we'll come back to this last one too. What is the use of going off here and there to practice? Or I said, the first line is, it's never apart from where one is. It's never apart from this very place. So that's to say that it's just in this very place where we find out about life. That means the very place where we're actually living. For instance, Maybe some of you are parents. I'm not, but let's just say some of you are. Say the moment when your baby is born. Something happens, something changes in your life. But where does it happen? It's just right here. It's right here in this moment. You don't think about other things. It just brings you right into this moment. That's where everything happens. Now, actually, you know, the birth of a baby is of course, very special. But in another way, it's not so extraordinary. It's just what's happening, moment after moment, every moment. Well, the same can be said when someone who we really love dies. All of a sudden, the moment just comes right to us. Of course, that has a different feeling than when our first baby is born. Then we feel a sense of deep, deep suffering. Then he goes on after stating these questions. He says, "And yet, if the least like or dislike arises in the mind, the mind is lost in confusion." So this is about my teacher Katagiri Roshi would talk about very often affected preferences. We have our affected preferences. So there's this whole world out there that we're looking at. We see it, we're looking at it right now. Just see it. So we divide it up into different things called people and this person and that person and the room and all things like that. But there's things we're picking out, you know, out of all this stuff. Things that we like, and things we don't like. And we're really giving those a lot of attention. It's putting the I, this I thing, in front of everything else. I like that. I don't like that. But it's all just here. Once, when I started my practice, I went to San Francisco Zen Center. And that was like in 1972 or 3, something like that. And in those days, everybody was eating brown rice. I think it was kind of a new thing. Relatively new. And everyone would walk around the Zen Center saying, "Oh, I love brown rice. I love brown rice so much. I love to eat brown rice. It's so healthy, and it makes you feel so good and everything." And personally, I didn't like brown rice. I didn't like eating it. In fact, I liked white rice. If I had to eat rice, I liked white rice better than brown rice. And I actually like potatoes better than either one. But in any event, I read a book, or you might know, Suzuki Roshi's, who was the abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center. In his book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, I found a passage once. I hadn't read that before I went there. But later, I read it, and he said, about brown rice, he said, "You should eat brown rice until you're sick of it." I thought, oh, it's like he got it. He didn't like that either, people going around saying, "I like brown rice, I like brown rice." You know, you're picking something out too much. Well, it's kind of like Orioke. Now, I don't know how many of you have done Orioke here, but in our retreat, we have this very specialized way of eating, with very ritualistic, you know, chopsticks go here, spoon goes here, fold the napkin up this way, fold it in thirds, put it down with your right hand here, you know, on and on. And so for me, I think, I don't know how many times I've done Aura Yoga. Today, during Zazen, I was trying to figure it out. I thought I don't know how many sessions I've said, like 300, 400, and three times a day, whatever. So I figured, is it 1,000? Maybe it's 10,000 times. And I thought, by now, I don't really care if I like it or don't like it, After a while, you just don't care anymore. In fact, but what happens sometimes, especially after sitting quietly for quite a while, we go to eat our meal. And for me, some of my quietest and most lucid moments have occurred while eating Aura Yoga. I think probably it has to do with the fact that I'm eating and I'm happy, after not having eaten or just sat still. I think that's a piece of it, this eating food. But I'm like more relaxed or something. So I just look down at it and I say, whoa, this is really interesting. Looking at these bowls and these spoons, it's like, I've never seen anything like this before. So then I have that feeling, and then I'll say, a little bit later, I'll say, I really like Aura Yoga. I like Aura Yoga. Then say session's over, You start talking, because we don't talk during session. And we start talking with each other. And then you ask them, well, how was your session? He says, well, my session was really good, except I really hate Aura Yoga. I really dislike Aura Yoga. All that's detail, I can't stand all that detail. It's like obsessive compulsive. It's at its limit. That's what they might think. And then you think, oh man, I don't know. Then you would get into a little argument about Aura Yoga. So that's how our likes and dislikes come up. Well, I'd like to encourage, one other point too is once I was sitting down in the office at the Minnesota Zen Center doing some work, and Katagiri Roshi came down, and I think I just had some kind of difficult situation with a person. And he kind of appeared at the door, and I looked up at him and I said, Roshi, my biggest problem is people. And he looks at me and says, me too. So we should just watch, what our preferences, our likes and our dislikes, and it'll come up most often with people. That's where it hits us the hardest. So I just encourage you to just see, where do those likes and dislikes arise from? Where do they come from? Explore it. See how far you can go into it. So then Dogen says, you should therefore cease from practice based on intellectual understanding and chasing phrases and learn the backward step that turns your light inward and illuminates itself. Body and mind of themselves will drop away. If you want to awaken to suchness, practice suchness without delay. So we talked in this retreat that this learning, the backward step, is something we have to learn. When we're doing Zazen, we're taking a backward step. Now, actually, backward step is just a phrase that tries to point something out. It just means that we're not doing the usual activity that we usually do, which is always going forward, trying to make some progress, trying to obtain something, to get something. The backward step means we come back to just this place and we just rest here without going somewhere else other than just here. That's going backwards. Not really going backwards, it's just not going forward. It's just trying to indicate what we do with this practice. Now, we have to learn that because it's not exactly just intuitive. So we have to be taught. Except, the big problem is, no one can actually teach anyone else how to do it. We have to learn it by ourselves. Also, there's the line important there is that the turning the light inward. So this turning is important. That's why one of my very most favorite things that Dogen says is, he says, sometimes we turn the wheel of the Dharma. And sometimes we are turned by the wheel of the Dharma. So that means we ourselves really have to make the best effort that we can. We turn, that's us turning the wheel of the Dharma. That means that we were all sitting here, just about all of us. How do we actually make our best effort to just only sit here? Just sit here and just be here. How do we make that best effort? That's us turning the Dharma. Then what happens is something turns us, but we don't know what it is. That's the Dharma turning us. We can't actually do anything. Too much. We just have to practice being here. It says body of mind of themselves will drop away. That means this thing called my body and myself and my mind and everything about it, it drops away. And that's why we continue to do this practice, because we can see and experience an ending of our self-obsession, of being obsessed with ourself. And when we experience the end of that obsession, we feel freedom like we've never felt before. So practice suchness without delay. So that's kind of hard. Because we're always saying, well, not now. not right now, you know. There's something really interesting I can think about right now. There's something else to be concerned about. Not just this place right here. I have to say, during this retreat, I have been highly motivated. That's not always the case. But this retreat, I felt highly motivated to just do this practice. And yet I notice, so I make up my mind, I'm going to sit down here. I'm going to do this. Today, I'm going to really do it. I'm going to do this period of Zazen. And yet, when I get here ready to do it, something really doesn't want to do it. It doesn't want to really just continue to do it, maybe do it for a little tiny bit and then stop. It doesn't want to continue to do it. So this is our karmic condition that we always just have to work with. Because usually, what we might experience when we actually really start to do this practice is some kind of deep anxiety that we've never known before. Like, it might settle itself right in the middle of your guts. And you might just be sitting there with this thing that, ooh, this hurts. Something just hurts in the body. It's not about the mind. The mind sort of stopped. It's just this thing right in the middle of your guts. It just hurts. And you just have to stay with that hurt. How do you settle yourself then? Just stay with it. Do not think good or bad or administer pros or cons. Well, pros and cons are pretty up there in our brains, working pretty hard. The other day I thought, I did a pilgrimage. I was remembering I did this pilgrimage in Japan for a year where I went to different monasteries, temples, and stayed. And I discovered there were a group of us doing that, kind of a group that were just kind of moving to different monasteries and doing Zen at different temples. And you might think, you know, we had very lofty conversations about what we experienced in different temples. But the first thing, when we would get together, we would share stories, like share information, like, what was that temple like? You know, and we kept, you know, bumping into the same people, bumping in. You'd see them again 6 months later at another temple. And so we'd start recognizing each other and start talking about things. But the very first thing we talked about, the very first question was, can you guess?
Food.
Is the food good? What kind of food do you get? The very first thing is, how's the food? You might think that doesn't show very deep practice. But I'll tell you, you do not get fed very well in a Japanese monastery. After about 3 weeks of not getting fed very well, you start to think about food a lot. Like the morning meal. It's this little bowl of, it's not even rice. It's one part rice and nine parts water. I mean, it's thin. And that's it. And a pickle. You get a little pickle. Otherwise, you just get this little bowl of rice, you know, and you eat about 6 a.m. And by 7:45, you're really hungry. And you have a long ways to go till lunch. So you're really interested, you know, in food. Well, then, beyond that, there's, you know, the second thing is how much time do you get to sleep, you know, and then, and rest, and then free time, and then another one is how cold is it, you know, do they have any heaters, and then finally you get down, after spending about 45 minutes on that, finally you get down, oh, what about the teacher? What about the practice? What about the practice, you know, and the teacher? Is it good practice, you know? And so, oh, he's a great teacher. Oh, okay. Once all those other things, you know, are okay. So that's our pros and cons. We're always evaluating like that. Well, finally he says, just cease the movements of the conscious mind. That's all. That's all you have to do. However, when we do that, if we do this practice for a long time, we might get frustrated because if we make that best effort that we can to cease the movements of the conscious mind, we're just not having any success. You know, it's just, no matter how much I try, they don't stop. Nothing stops. So then, that's why one of my other favorite lines that Zen master said was by Hong Wang Po, who said, "Do not let the least movement of your mind disturb you." So even if your mind's moving, don't let that disturb you. Just let the movement be what it is. So it's not a battle against the thinking mind. It's kind of a surrender. But we have difficulty surrendering because we really, we have a very deep organic urge in our bodies to kind of a fierce energy that wants to compete and wants to win. We don't want to surrender. The only good thing about that is that the desire to fight and compete slows down when we get older. It slows down. So have no design, next he says, have no design on becoming a Buddha. Another one of my favorite sayings by Huang Po is, he says, ordinary people look to their surroundings for security. In other words, we're always looking outward, trying to get the right thing to feel secure in this world. That's our ordinary way. And he said, people who study the way, that means what we're doing. People who study this other way of not looking outside to their surroundings, but looking inside, they look to mind, capital M-I-N-D, which could also mean Buddha or enlightenment. They look to that for security. In other words, we're looking for something. When we sit down and do this practice, we're hoping for something, looking for something called mind. We don't know what to call it. Is it called, we read about things, we hear things called enlightenment, we hear things called Buddha, we hear things called mind, and we want that. What is it? I don't see it. Where is it? So he says, the true way is to forget them both. So we forget both about our surroundings, and we forget about enlightenment, searching for something, getting something. He said, the first, to forget about searching for your surroundings for security, is easy enough to do. It's easy enough. To stop looking outside for security. To forget about looking to Buddha or enlightenment, that's very difficult. Very difficult. He says, it's difficult because we are afraid. We can sense that. If we're quiet, we become quiet and still. And we just stay with that stillness. We can experience an immense amount of fear inside of us. What's it the fear of? It's the fear of losing everything. Because that's what happens. We lose everything. And it's the things we love. Little by little, they just start being taken away. So it is simply the Dharma gate of joyful ease. And in this talk that I gave yesterday, or the day before yesterday, I talked about, actually, we really want to feel some joy when we're sitting. And I kind of suggested that if there's not like something joyful happening, maybe we need to adjust in some way or another. If it's just getting more and more miserable, it's not probably, we're not probably on the right track. But I only say that, actually. I've only been saying that lately. Because I always used to emphasize, yeah, this is suffering, this is hard, and all that. Then I got really criticized. You know, people would say, I don't feel all that suffering and all that stuff. You should talk more about joy and happiness. So I said, well, okay. So yesterday I said, okay, let's talk about joy and happiness. Well, lo and behold, after I do that, someone comes in and says, I don't feel any joy. This is miserable. What can I say? Actually, they go together. They go right together. The more deeply we can enter and touch that place of suffering in our life, the more intimate we can become with it, the more we will experience some quiet kind of joy. Not excessive, just quiet, quite quiet. Then he says, why leave behind your own home to wander in vain through the dusty realms of other lands? Well, that's, to me, that's one of my favorite lines in this. Why leave? Where do you think that means? Where is our own home? It's just here. This is our own home. Why leave behind the seat in your own home? This is the seat right here in my own home. Why leave this and wander around in the dusty realms of other lands? That's all my circulating around in the universe, wherever I go, imagining this, imagining that. I'm leaving the seat in my own home, which is right here. And I imagine things, and I imagine the day when this is going to happen, and then I'm going to be really happy when that happens, and this and that and the other thing. It's all dusty stuff. You have gained the pivotal opportunity of human form. So this means we need to really deeply appreciate this human form we have. We're not always so aware of that. He follows that with, who would take wasteful delight from the spark of the flintstone? So that means we really need to exercise as much effort as we can while we have this human form, while we have it, while it can move around okay and think okay. You know, all those things will disappear. Our ability to use our mind, our ability to use our body are completely decreasing as we go on in our lives. please, honored followers, continue to live and practice in this way, and your treasure store will open of itself, and you may use it freely. I've finished 90 seconds ahead of time. Thank you very much.
Actually, Gokai, we still have, I think, 3 minutes.
3 minutes?
We coordinated all the clocks. We forgot to coordinate your watch.
No, I coordinated it. I have 2 minutes. I have 2 minutes. 10:22 I have to end, and it's 10:20. How about a question or a comment? Or as I always say, a rebuttal. Yes.
Can I just tell you how happy I am that you told me that you talked about Oriyuki?
Oh, okay.
It's like I had an experience in session. I just hadn't had that experience of like, wow, this is amazing. So thank you for that.
Oh, okay. It took me a lot of years before I had that experience. Yes, Tom.
There's been a back and forth in the New York Times this week based on an article that somebody wrote called Stop the Meditation Madness. I didn't read the details of it, but he said basically, well, you can get the same benefits from other ways. And my thought was, and then there's been some like psychologists writing back saying, no, it's good for you, and so on. And my thought is, well, you can't get any benefits at all. And if you want benefits, you're not going to get anything.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Can you say it just a little louder?
You had talked about like how we lose everything.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then the question pops into my head, do we ever really lose anything? Or does it just change?
Yeah. Well, I think the thing is we actually never have anything to begin with. But we think we do. I mean, we really think, something's ours. This is my kid. This is my this, that, or the other thing. This is my feelings. Whatever they are, we believe they're ours. We really believe there's something here that is mine. That's so strong. And all life is telling us there's nothing here that's yours as we go on. We're just all part of one substance. We can call it one substance, but what does that mean? All we're finding out through all these things we lose that hurt is just what reality is. That we never had it in the first place, though we believed we did. We believe I have my body here, but it's not mine. The Buddha says, if it were yours, wouldn't you just keep it forever? Is such a thing possible? He would ask his monks, and he says, no, it's not possible, sir. Well, your body's not yours.
Now we're done.
Okay.